suppose something asked to be quite as conceptually vexing as some of the ones that I talked about, although it might be, depending on the nature of the solution. If the nature of the solution is much more radical than many of us anticipate, it might be. But it's still an extremely important problem, and one that there's very likely, to be a lot of experimental progress on in the next 5 years. So that's something particularly important to know about. And the whole thing might actually, there's been a lot of experimental excitement just in the past year or so. And there's real room for a lot more progress in this decade. And it also ties in quite remarkably with some of the earlier things that I was telling you about as well. So this is one of the nice indications, perhaps, of this real unity between physics at all the different length scales that I've been alluding to a number of times. So this is the problem of dark matter. Are there going to be lectures on, are there going to be any dark matter lectures? Do you guys know?
No.
Specifically? Okay. All right, fine. So this could be a sort of lecture series in itself, and I want to spend an hour on it. So let me just quickly cut to the, how many of you know about, have heard about dark matter? Okay, how many of you know about the evidence for it from rotation curves of galaxies? All right, let me quickly review this. So the overall statement is that most of the mass in the universe today does not seem to be in stars or ordinary stuff, but seems to be in something, we infer that it's in something dark, something that doesn't carry any electric charge, it doesn't interact with E&M in the way everything else does. And the evidence for this began when people were looking at galaxies and looking at and measuring the velocity of stars rotating around the center of the galaxy. You can measure these velocities in many ways by looking at the Doppler shift, for example, of frequency lines that you know should be out there. Okay. Now, there's a very obvious and qualitative prediction that you can make if you believe Newtonian gravity. Okay? If you believe Newtonian gravity, then if you make a plot of the velocity as a function of the distance away from the center of the galaxy, then you should expect that, of course, right towards the center, the velocity is small. At the center, it's zero. Okay? But you'd expect that at very large r, see, most of the mass is concentrated in the center of the galaxy, where things are brightest, right? So as you get out here, you would start expecting that, most of the mass is here. So if this star is going to just be rotating around the galaxy, bound by its gravitational attraction, its velocity should go down, right? Just keep going down and down. In order, it's further out, the force is smaller, so the velocity had better be smaller in order to be able to continue to go around. Okay, in fact, you would expect it to go down like 1 over r, right? The b squared over r should be go like 1 over r squared, so you'd expect that the you should expect the v squared to go down like 1 over r. Anyway, so you expect something like this from Newtonian gravity. Is that clear? But what people found instead, by looking at many, many galaxies, is that the velocity curve instead did this. It flattens out. That's the Newtonian expectation. And this is observation. Okay? And this similar phenomenon was noticed at several length scales. So this is looking at the velocities of, this is looking at the velocities of stars in a galaxy. The same phenomenon was noticed looking at the typical velocities of galaxies moving in big clusters of galaxies. Okay, again, if you look at all the mass you think is out there in the big clusters of galaxies and look at the typical velocities were larger than you'd expect from what would keep everything bound together gravitationally. Okay? So this was used to argue that there should be some missing mass that we're not seeing, okay? And that mass is what's actually dominating the force that's keeping these guys going around the center of the galaxy. Now, by now, these were the original hints. By now, there's lots and lots of other hints that there is this missing dark matter. One of the most compelling things, there's lots of compelling things. And I should tell you, in the modern picture, it's not like the dark matter is also here. There's this big dark matter halo, much larger than the size of the galaxy, that's surrounding the galaxy. Okay? And so the galaxy is much, much, much smaller. Okay? But if you look, there's evidence for this from all sorts of different length scales. Also cosmologically, at the very, very largest length scales, the amount of mass, non-relativistic mass, mass whose energy density scales like 1 over r cubed as the universe expands. Okay? That bit is around 5 times larger than the observed mass in ordinary stuff, baryons. Now, you might have thought, and many things have been ruled out by now, you might have thought maybe these are Jupiters, okay? Things that just don't shine, but they're just ordinary stuff. Maybe they are Jupiters. Well, if they're Jupiters, you would have expected to see some gravitational lensing signals associated with them that we're not seeing. Okay? On the other hand, people have been able to indirectly measure the entire mass of a galaxy by looking at how it gravitationally lenses sources behind it. And that lensing is consistent with this picture that most of the mass is in something dark. It's not a very, very, very precise measurement of the total mass, but it's definitely very, very consistent with the idea that most of the mass in the galaxies is dark and so on. So it would take an entire lecture for me to talk about. It would take an entire lecture for me to talk about all the observational evidence for this. That's which is all so far indirect, but extremely compelling. So before just asserting that dark matter exists and moving on, I want to spend 5 minutes talking about an important general principle, or lack of general principle, about what to do when you're confronted with something very puzzling like this in data. Okay? So how many of you would look at this and say, why the heck are you adding dark matter? Isn't just this obviously telling you that Newtonian mechanics is wrong? How many of you are tempted to say that? Very good. I don't commend you for your taste, but but it's a perfectly logical question to ask, right? How do we know? How do we know? In fact, there are people. There's a whole attempt to explain this by modifying Newtonian dynamics in some way. And there are several problems associated with it. But the dominant one of which, there is not a single nice, sensible theoretical framework in which this really makes sense. Okay? You can't just willy-nilly screw with Newton's laws, and hope to make it relativistic, and hope to make anything else make sense. And people have tried and really, really tortured themselves, but still, it's a horrendously ugly contraption. It just, to many, many of us, smells like it's the wrong way to go. Although it's something that you should definitely read about and learn about. If you just Google modified Newtonian dynamics or MOND, you'll see there's a big literature of people who tried to explain this. They even have some successes on their side. The MOND explanation for these galactic rotation curves is in many ways much more compelling than the dark matter explanation, just on the face of it. It doesn't have many parameters. It fits lots of data. So, but it's not a complete theory. Anyway, so I'm not going to talk about that. I'm not going to talk about that except to tell you the following parable. Yes, but go ahead.
I'm just curious how they deal
So I'm not trying to. I want to actually encourage you to go learn about MOND, just because it's what it succeeds at. It's very striking. I think it's likely that it's a kind of. It could be a kind of numerology, and we've had many examples of like this before in the history of physics. Like Bode's law is a wonderful example of a very, very simple formula that explained the distance of the planets from the sun that is very unlikely to have any fundamental significance. But that's not, yes, go ahead.
For something that is not directly, there's not direct evidence for. I'm just trying to understand.
That's right. There's no direct evidence for dark matter. Yeah. I'm going to tell you about what it might be and what kind of direct evidence we might get in the near future.
About a century ago, people similarly believed the existence of
ether. Yes, but very good. So this is in fact the parable that I was about to make. So people look at this very often and say exactly that. They say, look, in the current cosmology, we say something is making the universe accelerate. And you call it a cosmological constant or dark energy. By the way, whoever says dark energy, this is a way of trying to make foggy something which is very, very simple. Okay, the dark energy is 99.9999%, with 99.9999% likelihood the cosmological constant, as we were discussing in the first lecture. Just a vacuum energy. Not a single other theory exists that comes anywhere near the economy and simplicity of that explanation. And so people want to make it sound fancier, but it's not some deep, mysterious thing we don't possibly understand what could make the universe accelerate. Quite the contrary. Every theory we've ever written down has a vacuum energy, badly wants to make the universe accelerate if the energy is positive. It's what's confusing is its magnitude. They said it's accelerating so slowly, not that the universe is accelerating and there's some mysterious dark energy that we don't understand, as I said. But people often say, they say, look, you have dark energy, you have dark matter. This is just like the ether all over again. You guys are idiots. Don't you remember Einstein told you things that you can't see, be suspicious of them, and so on? If only life were so simple, okay? If only it were so simple that every time you're confronted with a puzzle, you say, that's it. We got to chuck everything, you know, start all over again. Everything is wrong. Everything that came before is wrong. As I've said a number of times, if there was a uniform principle like that for how to make progress in science, that's just what we teach. The problem is that that you never know ahead of time whether the solution to a given puzzle is going to require you to is going to require a revolutionary step, or is going to require conservatively holding on to the things that have come before. In fact, the example of dark matter provides a beautiful, there's a beautiful historical parable analog of exactly the same issue. Okay, so in the 1800s, people were learning how to calculate the positions of the planets with more and more accuracy. Okay, and as many of you know, Leverrier predicted Neptune. Predicted where Neptune should be by looking at the deviations in the orbits of some of the outer planets. Now, people could have taken the attitude back then, Newtonian mechanics is wrong. Look at that. It's a small effect, but Newtonian mechanics is wrong. Things are out there. So we're starting to see the first signs that Newtonian mechanics is wrong. Or you could take the attitude, no, no, there's dark matter, dark planet. Okay? There's a dark planet out there, and we just have to add it. It's not such a big deal. You know, we just add it, and then we can even predict where it is. Well, he put in dark planet, and he figured out where it was, and that's where it was. Just as a small coda to this story, this is not well known, but Leverrier totally did the calculation wrong. It's a remarkable story. There's actually an American astronomer who did it right. Well, not astronomer. But Leverrier did it and got it wrong. It was completely lucky that Neptune happened to be where he predicted it to be. Total blind luck because the computation was wrong. Had he made his calculation, you know, 5 years earlier or later, presented the same calculation, Neptune would not have been there. So it's a very, very funny story. Very funny story. But anyway, forget that story. Let's assume that he did it right because it could have been done right. Okay. Actually, this American astronomer did it, physicist did it right. I wish I remember his name. But anyway, end of coda. But anyway, in that case, the answer was dark planet. Okay? And it wasn't a big, yes?
I did the same thing when I thought there should be a bigger planet. Found Pluto, which is much smaller than...
Right, right. Yes, yes, yes. But I'm just saying that this idea that this idea that you put in dark matter to explain deviations from gravity, you could have said Newtonian mechanics, we're just starting to see the cracks in Newtonian mechanics, and that would have just been wrong. Okay,
it's not important in science to be radical; it's important to be right. Okay, and so to say that to jump at every opportunity and say this is the place for the next revolution. If it's wrong, then it's completely pointless. Now, however, buoyed by that success, people went on and tried to explain the position of the perihelion of Mercury by introducing the smaller planet, Vulcan, that went around the sun. And that was wrong. Okay. So, by the way, it also didn't work. So this is the real path to progress. You try to explain every new thing you can, not by throwing everything out, but by sticking as much as possible to the hard-earned things that you've learned so far, and start trying to make small modifications to it. Okay? A hint that there might be something really wrong is if, like, no reasonable small modification starts to work. No reasonable inversion of Vulcan worked. Okay, reasonable versions of Neptune worked. I think it's a really nice example because it shows that the same kind of problem can sometimes have a radical solution, sometimes have a conservative solution. We never know ahead of time which is which, and you know, you make progress by doing the most concrete thing you can, and if it works, great. And if it doesn't work, you learn something, and you might be continually pushed to more and more radical solutions. The same thing was true with the ether, by the way. Okay. We do a lot to disparage the ether, and of course it isn't there. It's very important. It's very important that it's not there. But it's remarkable that this thing that we make fun of all these people for believing was precisely what they believed in order to discover Maxwell's equations. You know, Maxwell, in discovering Maxwell's equations, was building a mechanical model of the ether. Okay? He wasn't writing down equations. He was literally making a mechanistic picture of the world with gears and wheels and cogs and things like that, in order to try to explain why it was that electromagnetic waves had only two polarizations and they didn't have a long and only two transverse polarizations. So people had settled experimentally by the 1820s, 1830s, that light was some kind of wave, and it had polarization, and only transverse polarization. And so people said, let's make it a wave of some medium. But it's not so easy to come up with a medium that doesn't give you the sound wave component of a wave, the longitudinal compressional component that only had the transverse components. That's why he was building this little model with cogs and gears and wheels and things, so that when you pushed it, there were flywheels and they moved around, and so somehow they only gave you transverse displacements. Okay? It's one of the wonderful ironies of the history of physics that that taking the ether ultra seriously, and building a model for it in order to explain the actual phenomenon led Maxwell to the equations that eventually led to the overthrow of the ether, when people realized that those equations were Lorentz invariant, and Einstein realized that you should in fact interpret them as something that told you there was no ether. Okay, so but it's a fantastic indication of how progress works. It's even possible doing wrong things to get the right answer, as long as you're sticking as much as possible to trying to explain the phenomenon, honestly. Okay. So even believing in the ether was not such a bad thing. Believing in it for too long was of course a bad thing. But anyway, the number one rule in progress, the number one rule of progress in science is better to do something than to twiddle your thumbs. And so you always take any phenomenon and try to explain it with the minimum modification to the structure that you've built already. Okay? And again, if it doesn't work, and you have to make it increasingly complicated and increasingly contorted to explain, especially striking qualitative facts, you know something is wrong. That's really also what happened with the ether. The failure to discover the motion through the ether started making more and more people wonder that something was up. Okay? I would say the status with dark matter right now is that the simplest possibilities for what it might be are still perfectly consistent with experiment, and we may get direct hints that these particles exist any time now. Okay? So that's what I want to tell you about. Yes?
I think there's a whole variety of experiments that could directly or indirectly detect it, and I think the second there's some indication of the particle nature of dark matter that makes up most of the mass.
It really depends.
But this is not something I care to speculate about. Okay. So
what I want to now just spend a few minutes telling you about is what it might be. So the simplest thing that it could be is some kind of massive weakly interacting particle. So people call these things WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles. Okay. Why is it weakly interacting? Well, actually, one of the main features that the dark matter has to have is that it has small self-interactions. That's why you get these big halos of the dark matter particles surrounding the relatively smaller galaxy. It's so big because these clumps of dark matter formed under their own gravitational self-interaction. There's a bigger picture that this ties into, that early on the universe was hot and dense and mostly uniform, with tiny inhomogeneities, very small inhomogeneities of about a part in 100,000. One part in 100,000 difference between the temperature here and there and there and there. Okay? We know that now from observations originally from the COBE satellite and in the late 90s from the WMAP satellite that measured the cosmic microwave background temperature very accurately, that you could see that there was tiny one part in 100,000 differences between the temperature here and there and there and there and there everywhere in the universe. Okay. Now, where those tiny inhomogeneities come from is a whole other wonderful story. It's very likely coming from inflation, which explains many, many other things. But we don't need to know that for this discussion. Somewhere, there is a small source of inhomogeneity. Now, the universe cooled and cooled and cooled. As the universe cools, the temperature in the radiation starts going down relative to temperature in non-relativistic objects. The reason is that the radiation is just getting stretched by the expansion of the universe. Okay? The wavelength is getting stretched, so every single photon, any individual photon's energy is going down because the universe is expanding. Okay? So not only is the energy going down like 1 over the volume because everything is getting more diluted, the energy density, but the actual energy of every individual photon is going down as well. Whereas if you have a proton or a neutron or electron sitting there, their energy is staying constant. So their energy density just goes like 1 over the radius of the universe cubed, whereas the energy density and temperature goes like 1 over the radius to the fourth. So even though very early on, even though very, very early on, most of the energy in the universe was in radiation, as the universe expands and the radius gets bigger, at some point, the energy in the matter takes over. Okay? When the energy in the matter takes over, the radiation is getting so dilute that you start making atoms. They don't get ionized anymore, and so you can start having a universe that starts looking like it's composed of the things that we see around us today. But these tiny 1 part in 100,000 differences in the original temperature means that there's tiny 1 part in 100,000 differences in everything, in the local number density or the mass density of any non-relativistic objects that might be lying around. And that means that even though it's a minuscule 1 part in 100,000 effect, gravity can now take over and enhance that. Because in this region, there's a little bit more mass than in that region. That means that this region can start collapsing under its own gravitational forces. Okay? And so that starts making the size of these inhomogeneities bigger and bigger until it becomes something of order 1. Okay? So you start getting a big cloud here of matter that's collapsed under its own weight. And over here, there's a void. There's nothing. And over here, there's a big cloud. And over here, there's a weight. You start getting a very clumpy universe, like the universe that we observe on slightly smaller scales. Okay. And now, dark matter should be relatively weakly interacting, because more or less all it needs to do is clump like that gravitationally and just swirl around in a gravitationally bound cloud. The reason our stuff is smaller, the reason galaxies are smaller, is that galaxies then fall into these gravitational wells that are set up by the dark matter. But because they can couple to light, even if they're neutral, because they have electromagnetic interactions, they can cool. They can collide into each other and give off energy by throwing out photons. Okay? So that means that even though everything starts off with these big virial clouds of things swirling around, the galaxies get smaller and smaller. They get smaller and smaller because they can lose energy and fall further and further down into the gravitational potential set up by the dark matter. You don't want the dark matter to be able to do the same thing. Okay. Okay? So that's why it has to be relatively weakly interacting. Yes?
Just a slight, perhaps dumb question. You were saying that as the universe expands and radiation dilutes, but it also loses, it doesn't just dilute, it actually loses energy.
Yes, yes.
Where is that energy going?
Energy is not conserved in the universe. You've been lied to. Okay? And there's a good reason why energy is not conserved. Energy conservation is a consequence of what? Right. Energy conservation is a consequence of time translational invariance. The universe is not very time translational invariant. Okay. So there is no such thing as conservation of energy for the universe. Period. Yes?
Sorry, I thought it was a slightly different reason, if you could clarify. So my impression was that it doesn't matter whether or not the actual physical situation is time translation invariant, but only whether that Hamiltonian is. And so I heard the explanation I heard was that the reason is that the Hamiltonian in general relativity, you can't define like a unique time translation.
No, that's a very bad explanation. It's technically correct, but it doesn't. There's many explanations like that, and which have that character. You should be suspicious of highly formal exponentials, right? There is, after all, I mean, where is the energy going, right? You see, the conservation of anything depends on what you define the system to be, right? In every situation, we keep expanding our notion of what energy is, or what momentum is, or what, whatever it is, in order to continue having some quantity which is conserved, right? So, if I throw this piece of chalk, the momentum of the chalk isn't conserved. We say that's okay, because the bigger system of me and the chalk, the momentum is conserved, right? Or me and the chalk and the earth, the momentum is conserved. So, you have to keep increasing the size of the system until you have one which is approximately or exactly translationally invariant for the question you were talking about, in order to be able to say that things are conserved. The problem is that the universe is the universe, and there is no bigger system in which it can be embedded. So now, there are some very formal sense in which you can say that energy is conserved, the energy is going into the expansion of the universe. Okay? That's the sense in which what you're saying H equals zero. People say that the energy in GR is always zero. The Hamiltonian is zero. So it's always conserved. Yes, but it's in a highly useless sense. It's in a sense of saying anything that you say isn't conserved, you say it went into the universe. Okay. Went into the expansion of the universe. It's true, but it's not very helpful. It's not the notion of energy conservation that's helpful for anything. The real problem is that the universe isn't the small part of a bigger system in which things are embedded in an approximately translational invariant way. The universe badly breaks, on cosmological scales, badly breaks time translational invariants. That's why there is the useful notion of conserved energy.
I feel like we're using different notions of translation invariant. Like, would you say that the Earth is not translation invariant, or not rotation invariant, because if you rotate it around its center, it looks different?
No. The Earth, because of mountains and stuff like that.
Right.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
But angular momentum, you know, is still conserved on the Earth, even though the Earth is not rotationally invariant.
Well,
the laws are rotationally invariant.
Maybe we're going to have this discussion later. So this is immaterial to the point you're making. But as far as cosmology is concerned. It is true that there is a formal notion of a Hamiltonian which is always zero in GR, but it's a very useless notion. Precisely because it's always zero, it's a very useless notion of energy. And what it tells you is that, I mean, it's physically true. The photon is getting stretched as the universe expands. It's just life. It's true. The background in which photons and everything else lives is not time translation invariant. And so, you know, even though nothing is happening, nothing is touching it other than the universe expanding, the photon sitting here loses energy. Right. So you have to ask, if you want, you can always say well, that energy is going into making the universe expand. That's the sense in which energy is always conserved. But it's really not in the same way that we're used to talking about it in other systems. So whatever the dark matter is should be relatively weakly interacting, so yes.
You said the non-homogeneity of the universe is can maybe one in 1,000.
One part in 100,000, 10 to the minus 5.
Now, if you look at the scale of the universe and maybe like the Planck length, could we not say the non-homogeneity of the universe can have an effect in the quantum fluctuation that we observe at that small scale? Because at the level of the universe, we already have a fluctuation of 1 over 10,000.
We're talking about different kinds. Well, we're talking about different kinds of fluctuations. I'm talking about literally the universe is not translationally invariant on very large scales. On very large scales, and when we could look back early enough, that the universe had not yet started clumping. Okay. So when we look at the cosmic microwave background, we're getting light from the time when the universe first became transparent. Okay. And when it first became transparent,
things had not had a chance to clump. We're seeing it in a very, very, in a nearly homogeneous state. Okay. So we are just seeing that it was not translation invariant. There, the temperature is different than theirs, there, and so on. Okay? The fluctuations that you're talking about and that we were talking about earlier are quantum fluctuations. Okay? They're quantum fluctuations which are perfectly consistent with the universe being translationally invariant. Okay? Let me say it another way. If you wanted to detect those quantum fluctuations, you would have to like do some measurement here. If you do some measurement here, well, okay, of course, you're going to see something going on here because you're doing the measurement here. But it's perfectly consistent with the picture that the quantum fluctuations themselves, the vacuum, is translationally invariant. Okay? Approximately, the vacuum at short scales is approximately translationally invariant. Having said that, one of the incredible things about the idea of inflation is it gives an origin for where these tiny fluctuations come from. These tiny fluctuations in the microwave background. Okay? These tiny fluctuations, which are classical fluctuations, you know, they're actually the photons coming from there, not the vacuum, but the actual, you know, non-vacuum, the actual photons coming from this direction are hotter by a little bit than the photons coming from that direction. Inflation gives us a picture where those macroscopic classical fluctuations arise from underlying quantum fluctuation early on. When the universe started inflating. That's one of the most spectacular things in science, okay? That the macroscopic fluctuations that eventually, when gravity took over, gave rise to us and all the clumpiness in the universe arose from random quantum fluctuations at very, very early times. In an interesting time in the history of the universe where it was expanding exponentially quickly so that these quantum fluctuations didn't have a chance to cancel out, but really got stretched out by the acceleration of the universe to turn into the classical fluctuations that we talk about. So it was actually a very, very good question. If we're talking about something that's a quiescent Lorentz invariant vacuum, those fluctuations cancel out. You know, that so unless you're doing a local measurement here, if you do a local measurement here, you're probing the vacuum here. But you'll get the same answers if you do the experiment here, if you do the experiment there. The vacuum is translationally invariant. But when the universe was accelerating early on in the epoch of inflation, exactly those quantum fluctuations got stretched out and imprinted on very, very large scales and turned into precisely these tiny one part in 100,000 fluctuations that we see today. I mean, it's a really extraordinary thing because you might have wondered, where could all this complexity in the world come from? If the universe starts from some simple initial state, how could you possibly get all this complexity? And the answer is quantum mechanics combined with inflation, combined with some mechanism to allow you to stretch those quantum fluctuations out over very, very large distances. Okay. So anyway, this is one idea for what the dark matter could be. It could be weakly interacting massive particles. And one thing that we know about it is what its approximate energy density is today. Its approximate energy density today is, at the squiggle level, I told you it's 5 times bigger than mass and so on. But this is one of the amazing things about the universe. I think I alluded to some of it before in the first lecture. Every energy density in the universe is the same number at the squiggle level. And it's all this number, 10 to the minus 3 electron volt to the fourth. Okay. That's the dark matter, that's the radiation, the cosmological constant. All of these things are comparable. In fact, if I draw this picture, here is radiation, here is matter. I'm drawing the energy density in different things as a function of the size of the universe. The cosmological constant, remember, the cosmological constant is constant, right? The energy density stays constant. Then, oops, that's a great constant. Oh, geez. Why can't I draw a straight line today? All right, I'm giving up. Okay, the remarkable thing is that we happen to live in an epoch of the universe where all three of these values of all three of these sources of energy density are roughly comparable to each other. Okay? It didn't have to happen that there was any epoch where that happens, right? Two lines cross at a point somewhere. There's no reason for three lines to come close to crossing at a point. But it just so happens to be that's one of the funny things about the universe we live in, that all three of these forms of energy density are comparable, and they're all roughly given by this scale. Okay. So if you want to come up with a theory of dark matter, it's very, very, very easy. Invent any particle. Give it a nice name if you like. You can call it a WIMP. You can call it a neutralino. You can call it a Winnebago. You can call it anything you want. Yes? Electron volt, EV. We could translate it to GeV if you want. 10 to the minus 12 GeV to the fourth. These are also, by the way, 10 to the minus 3 electron volt around there is also the mass of the neutrinos, approximately. Okay. So a heck of a lot is going on at this very, very low energy scale, around 10 to the minus 3 electron volt. All right. And you give it any mass you want. You can say its mass is small. You can say its mass is the mass of a truck. Okay. Give it any mass you want, and just adjust its number density so that the energy density is right. Okay? As long as it's weakly interacting, that's perfectly fine, consistent theory of dark matter. Okay. It's also not particularly constrained or interesting and not very predictive, but it could be. Okay? It could well be. Why do we have this uncertainty? It's because we don't know what the number, we don't have an ab initio understanding of what the number density of the part of the dark matter is. Because that number density has something to do with the initial conditions of the universe. Okay? But there is one way in which it's possible to make a prediction. And that arises from making a very, very simple assumption. Okay? If we assume that these WIMPs have some kind of interaction. They don't interact directly with light, but if they have any kind of interaction with the rest of the particles of the standard model of particle physics, electrons, quarks, weak interactions, anything else, any other kind of interaction, gravity is not strong enough, as we'll see in a second. Any interaction, any reasonable, sizable interaction other than gravity, which does the following. Which ensures that early on in the history of the universe, they were in thermal equilibrium with everything else. Okay? If they were once in thermal equilibrium with everything else, then we know the initial conditions. Okay? Then we know what their number density is compared to our number density for all the particles, because everything was once in thermal equilibrium. Okay? In fact, even forget about these dark matter particles for a second. This is one of the big reasons why people believe in the Big Bang to begin with. And people started believing in the Big Bang really very strongly in the 60s and 70s, is because of the idea that if once upon a time, early on in the history of the universe, when things were smaller and hotter, everything was in thermal equilibrium, then just by doing very simple physics, you can make a prediction for the abundances of all the light nuclei. So very early on, when the temperature of the universe was of order, you know, let's say 10 MeV, hundreds of MeV, okay, very, very hot, all the particles that we know and love were in thermal equilibrium with each other. And as the universe cooled, so for example, it was hot enough. If the temperature was bigger than the binding energy of nuclei, if it was bigger than the binding energy of, 10 MeV, 100 MeV, then you couldn't make any nuclei form. You just have neutrons here, protons here, and if they formed, a hot photon would come along and just break them apart again, okay? So they'd all be in a big soup with each other. But when the temperature cooled enough, so the temperature went beneath the binding energy of nuclei, then something could start happening. A proton and neutron could come together and bind into a deuteron, And there would be not too many high-energy photons lying around that could undo that. Okay? And so you'd be left with some abundance of deuterium and lithium and helium and beryllium and all of these light nuclei. Okay? Now, at that point, you still just have nuclei and you have the electrons whizzing around. And the photon energies are still much higher than the binding energies of atoms. So you have these nuclei sitting here, you have these electrons whizzing around, and the universe keeps expanding and expanding until the temperature drops beneath the binding energy of atoms. And at that point, the atoms can start forming. Okay? But you get a very concrete way of predicting how many of each kind of nucleus was there. Okay? You all know that that stars make heavy elements, right? That you have fusion and you keep going and going and going, and you make heavier and heavier elements in stars, and then they go supernova, and that's how you throw out all these heavy elements into the universe. But it was really a puzzle where some of these light elements were coming from. When you look out into the universe, there's just pure amounts of helium or lithium or deuterium just lying out there, and it was hard to imagine how they were synthesized in stars. Okay, because the stars kept going until they made very, very heavy things, but not these light things. Well, the answer was that the early universe was like, had temperatures comparable to the temperatures inside stars. And it was the early universe that was synthesizing these things. Okay. So anyway, this allows you to, but see, there's no free parameters, essentially no free parameters in this calculation, other than there's one free parameter, essentially, which is what the number of photons is relative to the number of baryons. Okay? And the reason is that we don't have matter and antimatter in equal abundance. So that's another mystery why they're not in equal abundance. But the tiny asymmetry between them is a number that you have to fit in this calculation. But as a function of this essentially one free parameter, you could compute and predict the abundances of many light elements. And the fact that all of them work to few percent accuracy now is one of the really very, very strong pieces of evidence that there was a hot Big Bang. By which I mean there was a period in which the temperature of the universe was high and that all these things were synthesized. But it's just a straight, beautiful physics calculation, just thermal equilibrium in an expanding universe. Yes? Yes.
If I'm at equilibrium, I would like to stay at that state. So what prompted the universe to maybe start expanding?
Very good. We're actually going to see a very concrete example of that computation. I'm saying the universe was expanding. I'm saying the matter was in thermal equilibrium. The matter and photons and electrons and whatever else were in thermal equilibrium simply because as you go back in time, all the energies go up. These particles are banging into each other. If you put a bunch of energetic particles into a box, they will come to thermal equilibrium eventually. Yeah. In fact, we're going to do exactly, you can do an estimate for how long it will take for them to come to thermal equilibrium. And the amount of time for them to come to thermal equilibrium is faster than the rate at which the universe is expanding and pulling them apart, then they will come to thermal equilibrium. But in fact, precisely when that's going to break down, it's going to give us an interesting, it's going to tell us something right now. Okay? But anyway, I just want to say that this is a way of removing uncertainty about initial conditions. If you assume that things were once in thermal equilibrium. Now, for the standard model particles that we know and love, that's just true. Okay? We know their interactions, we know how they interact. If you extrapolate back early enough, they're just in thermal equilibrium. Okay? So it's not an assumption. But let's assume that it's true for these wimps. So let's assume that they interact enough with the standard model particles that they're once in thermal equilibrium. And let's now follow what happens. So what do I really mean? If they're in thermal equilibrium, that means that there's some process that takes two dark matter particles, whatever they are, and converts them into standard model particles, like photons. And backwards, forwards and backwards. So two of these dark matter particles can come along and annihilate and give rise to ordinary particles, and vice versa. Let's say that the cross section for this process is sigma. let's say the mass of the dark matter particles is n dark matter. Okay. Now, clearly, in order for these to be in film equilibrium, I have to imagine once upon a time that the temperature was much larger than the mass of the dark matter particle. So I really want to imagine that once everything was relativistic, the temperature was way bigger than that. Okay. Okay. Now, so actually, let's first talk about how the universe is actually expanding in this situation. Okay. Whenever the temperature is bigger than everything else, it's very simple to figure out the rate at which the universe is expanding. We worked on this formula the other day, right? The general formula
is that r dot over r squared is g Newton rho, rho over m Planck squared. This quantity, r dot over r, is often called Hubble. Okay? It's not a constant. It depends on time. As the universe expands, it changes and so on. Okay? But I'll often abbreviate it as h squared rather than keep writing r dot over r squared all the time. Okay? So h squared is rho over m Planck squared. Okay? Now, if the universe is dominated by radiation, what is rho? What is the energy density if you have a relativistic gas of particles of temperature T? This is something you can figure out by dimensional analysis. It's T to the fourth, okay? Because it has to have units of mass or energy to the fourth. So in radiation domination, so if this is radiation dominated, this is T to the fourth over m Planck squared. This is radiation domination. So just keep that in mind. You can now very easily work out, if you want, what r is as a function of t. We won't do that here. In fact, when you do cosmology, you very, very rarely ever talk about the time, the actual time. Okay? It's much more useful to talk about more physical things like the temperature or mass densities and so on. But anyway, okay, so just keep that in mind. All right, so let's say that initially the temperature of the dark matter particle is, the temperature is way bigger than the mass of the dark matter particle, the universe is expanding at this rate. Okay? Now let's first, in order to warm up, let's look at a different situation. Okay? Not the expanding universe, but something which has a part of the element of the expanding universe in it. So let's imagine that instead of the universe, we have a big box, and I've heated up this big box to a temperature way bigger than the mass of this dark matter particle. Okay, so I've just heated up the box. It's sitting there. So now in the box, I have some number density of photons. I have some number density of neutrinos, some number density of quarks, some number density of dark matter particles. What is that number density, by the way? What is the number density of photons at temperature T? What is the number density of any of these guys at temperature T? How many of them are there per unit volume? Yeah?
Density of the whatever equals the temperature, I would suppose.
So what is that?
Oh, well, so you have to check the right units first. So density. Number density has units of density, the space density, so energy to the negative 3. Temperature, unfortunately, has units of...
Sorry, you didn't quite say it right. Space is energy to minus 3, but density is 1 over space, so it's energy cubed.
Okay.
So number density is energy cubed, is temperature cubed. So the number density of all particles, relativistic particles, is T cubed. Okay, very good. So we know what everyone's number density is. Now let me crank down the temperature. just slowly by slowly, I'm going to crank down the temperature, so slowly that it's always staying in thermal equilibrium all the time. Okay? But I gradually crank down the temperature. The temperature hits the mass of the dark matter particle, and then it goes to 10 times lower than the mass of the dark matter particle. What starts happening to the abundance of the dark matter particle?
Yeah?
So the only reason we could do this calculation and hope to get a right answer is that particle production is possible.
Yes. So I'm assuming that everything is in the thermal equilibrium.
Well,
by drawing this picture, I'm assuming that there's no conserved particle number associated with the dark matter. That's right. So we can annihilate and can be created. Of course, if I don't do this, then I'm back in a situation that I can't make any predictions for what it is ab initio. So if these dark matter particles had some charge, they had some quantity that was conserved, then whatever their final abundance is determined by whatever that conserved amount is. I still can't make a prediction. But this is a very reasonable assumption. Very reasonable assumption. Okay. So as the temperature goes down, what happens to the number density of the dark matter particle? Let's say the temperature is 1/100th its mass. It's starting to rocket down exponentially, right, by the Boltzmann factor. And again, intuitively, why is that? It's because it's way easier for two of these particles to annihilate into two high-energy photons, okay, than it is to find two very high-energy photons way down the tail of the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, which have enough energy to remake these dark matter particles. Okay? So if we do that, and just the temperature goes down and down and down and down, then the number density of the dark matter eventually goes to zero. As you have the zero temperature, the number density goes down to zero. All right. Now, that's not quite the situation in the expanding universe for the following reason. What's happening is all the same physics is happening. Okay? The temperature hits the mass of the dark matter particle, and at first, the number density of the dark matter particle rockets down exponentially. Okay? But then something interesting happens. When the dark matter starts getting really dilute, and you see, in our box example, as the dark matter gets really diluted, if I still, if I wait long enough, two of them will run into each other and annihilate. Okay? But in the expanding universe, something else happens. When they start getting really diluted, then the expansion of the universe itself starts pulling them apart from each other faster than they can come find each other and annihilate. When that happens, they no longer annihilate. And you're stuck with whatever number density you had at around that moment. Okay? They want to annihilate, but the universe is pulling them apart. So they just can't find each other. They just can't find each other in order to be able to annihilate. This process is called freeze-up. It's one of the classic kinds of computations you do in cosmology. But it leaves you with another word that people associate with this is a relic abundance. There's a relic abundance of dark matter particles because their number density is frozen out when they can't find each other to annihilate. Yes?
The universe is so expanding that doesn't mean the number density is going down.
Yes, I'm sorry. Then, of course, number density keeps going down, but it's only going down with the number density. Yes. The number density is going down, but the total number of dark matter particles is then staying the same. They're no longer annihilating. Whereas beforehand, the total number was going down too. They're just annihilating. It's very hard to
remake them again. Okay. So after freeze-out, all that's going on is the number density is going down. Very good. Yes?
If there are that many annihilations, then I'm getting a little lost. Wouldn't we see a lot of the photons? Wouldn't it not be dark?
Very, very good. Let's come back to that comment a little later. But this is all happening very early in the history of the universe. Okay,
we're imagining, as we'll see, we're imagining the mass of this particle is fairly large, and so all of these annihilations are taking place when the universe was very hot. Okay, now when the universe was very hot, when the temperature was larger than when the temperature was larger than the binding energy of atoms. So when the temperature was larger than electron volts. The universe was both very hot and completely opaque. Okay, so because atoms hadn't formed, it was just plasma, and plasma of of electrons and photons and other stuff. So light didn't just freely propagate. Okay? All the light that we see now, we came to us in a straight line from the time when the universe first became transparent. Okay? Anything that happened earlier, we're not seeing that. These photons that were made in this process instantly thermalized with everything else which is lying around. Okay. However, we'll come back in a second for how you look for dark matter, and this is one of the ways that we can look for it today. If it's lying around today, every now and then they can annihilate today, and we can look for the decay products of that annihilation as a possible signal. Okay. All right, but I now just want to do an estimate to figure out something about what these properties have to be in order for this to give us the right answer. Yes? Yes.
We are talking about both.
Yes.
So why this analogy? If you have different states of matter.
No, I was just using the analogy in order to illustrate that the universe isn't just cooling. The universe is also expanding, and that means that at some point you fall out of thermal equilibrium. Okay? At some point, every process falls out of thermal equilibrium. In order for it to stay in thermal equilibrium, the typical time scale to reach thermal equilibrium has to be smaller than the rate than the typical age of the universe at any time. So that's really all I was using that analogy for. And this happens for every single process. Every process that gets you in thermal equilibrium will eventually stop keeping you in thermal equilibrium and expanding. Okay. So let's see when that happens. So, in order to stay in thermal equilibrium, we have to have that the typical mean free time between collisions is comparable to one over the mean free time between the collisions is comparable to the expansion rate of the universe. It should be larger than the expansion rate of the universe. Okay? So what is the mean free time between collisions? So let's say, again, I have this cross-section, sigma, for these annihilations. Let's say the number density of the dark matter particles has gone down to n dark matter. Now, all of this is happening somewhere around the mass of the dark matter, right? That's because at first, the number density is going down exponentially. Okay? So this is not going to be a, 1/1,000,000th the mass of the dark matter. If it was 1/1,000,000th, then we'd already be at a number density of order e to the minus 1,000,000. Okay? So forget it. So this is all happening somewhere in the vicinity of the mass of the dark matter, maybe 10 times smaller, 20 times smaller. It's not 1,000,000 times smaller than the mass of the dark matter particle. Okay? So all the temperatures are roughly the mass of the dark matter particle, give or take a factor of 10. Okay? So the typical rate, the rate at which these collisions happen, is then this formula that we mentioned already in the last lecture. It's given by n sigma. N sigma or n sigma v, 1 over n sigma v is the typical time scale between collisions. Now, because the temperature is kind of comparable to the mass of the dark matter particle, v is of order 1. So let's not worry about the v. Okay? But n sigma, n is rocketing down exponentially, right? N is rocketing down exponentially. But once it hits such a small number that n sigma becomes comparable to the expansion rate of the universe, then n will be stuck. Okay? So when does that happen? That happens when this becomes comparable to the expansion rate of the universe. Okay? Now, the expansion rate of the universe is t squared over m Planck from this formula, right? So h is t squared over m Planck. But we just said that the temperature is roughly the mass of the dark matter particle, right? So this is roughly m dark matter squared over m Planck. Let's call this at freeze out. All right? So I can get the formula then for the density of dark matter, the mass density of dark matter it frees out, which is m dark matter times n dark matter that frees out, which is, therefore, m dark matter cubed over sigma times m Planck. So that's what the density is then, when it froze out. Now, there's a wonderful way of figuring out what the density is now. Yes?
Sorry, just a quick point. Why does this have to occur at the approximate mass,
Well, it's simply because until this happens, until it becomes so dilute that the mean free time to keep it in thermal equilibrium is larger than the rate is smaller than the rate at which the universe is expanding. Until that happens, the number density is going down exponentially. It's just following the Boltzmann factor. Okay, and so all I'm saying is that if it's going to have any appreciable number density at all, it had better not be that Boltzmann. Either the minus that thing cannot be a terribly, terribly tiny number. We could soup this formula up by more correctly putting in the Boltzmann factor and solving it a little bit more formally. But what's clear is that, as I was saying before, the temperature shouldn't be like 1,000 times smaller than the mass of the dark matter particle at which this freeze out happens. Well, if it is, then the number density would be e to the minus 1,000. Okay? And e to the minus 1,000 of anything is not going to be anything that we can hope to see with any kind of reasonable number density. Okay? So it's guaranteed that this thing is happening relatively close by. But you could, if you like, do this more accurately by putting in the correct Boltzmann formula for what the number density is as a function of temperature, and then just demanding again that n sigma is comparable to t squared over m Planck. Okay, so that's a more correct way of doing it. Okay, so now we can figure out what the density is today by using one of the nice tricks in cosmology. Again, as I said, you almost never need to use the time variable. It's more useful to focus on really physical things like temperature. But here's a very nice fact. Rho of any kind of matter divided by the temperature cubed, this quantity is invariant as the universe expands. The reason is that rho matter goes like 1 over the radius of the universe cubed. The temperature goes like 1 over the radius of the universe. By the way, regardless of who's dominating, regardless of whether the temperature is dominating or matter is dominating or what's going on, regardless of what's going on, rho matter is just going like 1 over the size of the universe, and the temperature is just arising because the photons are getting stretched. Okay. So rho over temperature cubed is invariant. That means if I compute rho over temperature cubed, then it's the same as rho over temperature cubed now. Okay? So what is rho over temperature cubed? So rho dark matter, this is for any kind of matter. So rho dark matter over temperature cubed today, what's needed is this number that I said, 10 to the minus 3 electron volt. I said rho dark matter is 10 to the minus 3 electron volt to the fourth. I said the temperature is 10 to the minus 3 electron volt. Every scale in the universe on large is 10 to the minus 3 electron volt. So rho dark matter over temperature cubed today is 10 to the minus 3 electron volt. What is it then? Well, we just computed it then. Okay? This is rho. The temperature back then is around m dark matter, as we just said. So rho frees out over t cubed, rho over t cubed, rho dark matter over t cubed at freeze out is 1 over sigma times m Planck. This is very beautiful. We have learned what the annihilation cross-section has to be in order for this particle to constitute the dark matter of the universe. Okay, so let's put it in. So 1 over sigma, which units has units of what? Mass squared. 1 over sigma has to be 10 to the minus 3 electron volt times m Planck. So let's do this in GeV. So that's 10 to the minus 12 GeV times 10 to the, m Planck is 10 to the 19 GeV. Can I call it 10 to the 18 GeV? Would you kill me? You would not kill me. Okay. It's not 10 to the 18, but. Okay? So this is 10 to the 6 GeV squared. Well, isn't that interesting? This is the electroweak scale. This is a really remarkable fact. We're talking about cosmology, we're talking about dark matter, we're talking about all these things going on at enormous length scales. But the cross-section we need for a thermal relic to give us the correct mass density for the universe as dark matter, the cross-section is another scale that we talked about in the last lecture, the weak scale. Okay. Now remember, I told you that we had all these reasons to believe that there had to be new physics at the weak scale. Solving the hierarchy problem was one reason that we said there should be new physics at the weak scale. We had totally independent motivations that something is going on at the weak scale, coming from theoretical puzzles about scales and quantum fluctuations and all of that stuff. That was telling us that something has to be happening at the weak scale. And now this thing, entirely different set of arguments from a completely different part of physics, points to exactly the same scale. So in fact, what could the dark matter be? What is the easiest way to have a particle interaction that's set by a given mass scale? The easiest way is for the particles to be weigh that much. Okay, the particles weigh around 100 or 1,000 GeV. They have ordinary size interactions, just like everything else. They have alphas that are like our alphas. You know, everything is nice and normal in that sector. It's just that they weigh hundreds of GeV. So this is a remarkable coincidence, if nothing else. By the way, it does show you one of the interesting numerological facts, that the weak scale squared is the scale of the, the weak scale squared is the cosmological constant. Is the geometric mean of the Planck scale and the cosmological constant scale to the quarter. Okay. This is the numerological fact that we just discovered. Now, it doesn't have to be that this is what dark matter is. It doesn't have to be a thermal relic. It could be other things. It could still be a Winnebago. It could still be all sorts of other particles that were never in thermal equilibrium. This doesn't prove that, this is assuming that dark matter is there, which is a very reasonable assumption, but assuming more about what its properties are. But again, you do the simplest possible thing, And you don't find some crazy scale you've never thought of before. You find a scale that from completely independent arguments, you expected something to show up there. Okay, so that's quite striking. Yes?
When you were having the dark matter in thermal equilibrium in the early universe, you just drew a Feynman diagram with photons, but wouldn't the cross-section of photons have to be zero?
Not necessarily, no.
Or would it have to be zero now, or otherwise it would radiate?
No, it doesn't have to be zero, because the cross section isn't necessarily that. Perhaps had I drawn something like this that involved a single photon, that means that it has a charge. But you can definitely have interactions that give off photons.
We would see them, and they wouldn't be dark. Can't you have no coupling to it?
No, but that cross-section is, the cross-section that we're talking about that has a, you say, because we say the photon come along, hits the dark matter particle, the dark matter particle goes off, and the photon comes off, so we can see it. That's fine, but that cross-section is a minuscule number, is the weak scale square. Okay? This is a very short distance cross-section. This is not like, it's not like me seeing you, which is a very long range, very, very long range thing.
So they couple of photons just very, very weakly.
Yes, that's right. And they can. And this is weakly interacting. Indeed. And we see the measure of its weak interaction. It's really very, by conventional scales, it's very weakly interacting. It just happens to be a scale that we know about in particles. But that being said, in most theories, it's a suppressed. Going to photons is suppressed compared to going to other things.
Right,
well, going to W's and Z's, going to electrons, going to the other particles.
In early universe plasma, you could still have them in thermal equilibrium even without photon coupling, because they could couple to quarks, which couple photons. So
yes, exactly. Yes.
So can you find any energy density of, in the universe of photons today that would come close to, having reasonable numbers? If you had a gamma ray burst,
yeah,
would you have enough photons to have a reasonable number that interact with the dark matter particles in the area?
You mean have the no. What you could do is so let me actually tell you. Okay, good. So let's actually say what the number density is today. Okay, what does this correspond to? This number density, you can work out just do it for yourself, a little exercise, what it corresponds to, how many of these dark matter particles per actual human per meter. Okay? But I'll tell you the answer for what it is here on Earth. Okay? Here on Earth, it's more than it is in aggregate. If you take it out and you average it out over the whole universe, it's smaller. It's smaller by about a factor of 10 or 100,000. Okay? That it's smaller by a factor of 10 or 100, roughly, from what I was telling you before, that we started with these tiny fluctuations and they ended up getting a lot bigger. Compared to what its total average density is, if you average it over the universe, here locally it's bigger. Here locally what it is, if the masses are around hundreds of GeV, is one for every centimeter cubed. Sorry, one for every liter. One for every liter. Okay? So there's one dark matter particle per liter. One here, one there, one there, one there. Okay. It's pretty small, but it's big enough that you could try to go look for it. So let me in fact tell. So but that gives you an idea of how diluted it is. Okay. So it's anything which is coming along. Would have to hit one per. It's really incredibly dilute. Okay. So how can we look for it then? So let me just tell you how we could look for these dark matter particles, assuming that they're WIMPs like this. People have come up with three ways of looking for them. And the three ways for looking for them all involve taking this picture that we know had to be there in the early universe. So this could be any kind of standard model particle. So let me not call it dark matter, standard model. Okay? People do it by taking this picture that tells us that there has to be some interaction between this stuff and our stuff. And they read time in different directions in this picture. Okay? So one thing that you could do is read time in that direction. So you could make dark matter particles by scattering standard model particles together at a very high energies. Okay? Well, that's what will happen at the LHC. The energies should be in the range of the energies that you need to make these particles. And so the cross-sections that we're supposed to probe at the LHC are exactly this size cross-sections. So everything is in the ballpark of being able to make these guys. Okay? So one thing you can do is directly produce the dark matter particles at the LHC. Now, the way you know that you've made the dark matter, so this is, again, in more detail, this is a more involved story. And in fact, typically, the cross-sections for directly producing the dark matter particles are smaller than the cross-sections for making other particles that then decay down to dark matter particles. Okay? But one way or another, you're in the ballpark of where you're making these guys. And the way that you know you've made something dark is by noticing some missing energy from the event, just the way people discovered neutrinos a long time ago. So again, there's a more detailed story to say about that, but that's roughly what it is. You either produce the dark matter particles directly, or you produce them in the decay of other particles. And this is easier when you produce them in the decay of other particles. It's not so easy to have two protons collide to each other and look for nothing coming out. Okay? It's easier to see something's coming out and then see some mismatch of the balance of momentum and energy. If you see a mismatch of the balance of momentum and energy, then you know that these guys are, then at least there's some evidence that you've made something which is very weakly interacting with matter. Okay. So the LHC could be a dark matter factory, and you could just make them and begin to study its properties. Now, a little estimate that you can do is just to see that these guys really don't interact with the detectors at all. You should estimate, given what you know about it, how big a hunk of lead would you have to stick in front of the LHC in order to stop these dark matter particles coming out. Okay? That's a nice estimate that you can do, but it is not the size of the hunk of lead that's actually there by several orders of magnitude. Okay? So they really sail through the detectors, and so the only way you notice them is by missing energy. So that's one way. Direct production of dark matter particles should be possible at the accelerators. Yes?
Do you need more or less light to stop them compared to neutrinos?
That's an excellent question for you to work out. And also, if you think about it a little bit more, it's not quite an invariant question that you ask. Because the cross-section for neutrino scattering depends on the neutrino energy. But given what you know, and that cross-section is very small for low energies. So for low-energy neutrinos, the length that you need to stop neutrinos is way larger. If neutrino energy is comparable to the weak scale, then all the cross-sections involved are comparable between neutrinos and these guys. Okay? So it's comparable to the hunk of lead you need to stop a weak scale neutrino. But you should figure out what that is. Okay. Now this is nice because you directly produce these particles, but that's not what you want to do in order to see that these particles are exactly actually out there, right? You would also like to see these particles are actually out there. So you can also view time going that way. So what does this mean? This means that that you have some ordinary particle sitting here, some dark matter particle comes along, and it bangs into it. So ordinary in, ordinary out, dark matter in, dark matter out. Okay. Now, these interactions are incredibly weak. So what you have to do is to have a really high density of ordinary matter, but put it somewhere very far away from other crappy things that can bang into it. So that's why people build these experiments. These are called direct dark matter detection experiments, which are all, roughly speaking, gigantic hunks of metal. Okay? Big, big hunks of metal made of different and relatively heavy nuclei, if possible. Okay? So germanium, sodium iodide, and so on. But you take these big hunks of material, and you put them in very, very deep underground places, down deep in mines or down deep in tunnels in different places around the Earth. You put them deep underground to shield them from cosmic rays, okay, because you don't want cosmic rays coming and banging into these guys. But then what you do is they're very deep and they're very cold, and there are these heavy nuclei sitting there. The dark matter particles are small, right? Their size is 10 to the minus 17 centimeters. The scale is hundreds of GeV. And they're sitting there, so they're going to come along and bang into the nucleus. And when they bang into the nucleus will recoil. So you look for the nuclear recoil sitting deep in the heart of this big hunk of material. Okay? That's another kind of experiment that people do. And these experiments are really getting into a point where they're probing the interesting part of the parameter space here. They're really probing the kind of relevant cross-sections that we are talking about are starting to really be probed by these experiments. And there's a whole slew and variety of them. Another set of experiments, I think the most exciting set of experiments, to my mind, involve yet another kind of technology that use liquid noble gases, like xenon. And they take big vats of xenon. But it's the same principle. You have this vat of xenon. You wait for a dark matter particle to come along. It bangs into the nucleus. It shakes the nucleus, and it gives off light. It also ionizes the atom that the nucleus is attached to. And you look for both of those signals coming from deep in the middle of this gigantic detector. Now, there are backgrounds that you have to worry about from these experiments, from natural sources of radioactivity, from all sorts of other things. But you try to make it as quiet as possible, as cold as possible, and try to look for this. Okay? There are all sorts of clever things that you can do to try to convince yourself that that you're seeing evidence for dark matter, for example. One of them is that as the Earth goes around the Sun, we are changing our velocity relative to the dark matter. Okay? So we can have more relative velocity relative to them and less relative velocity relative to what the dark matter is. See, the entire solar system is going around the center of the galaxy. The dark matter is sitting there sort of more or less virialized. Okay? It's not rotating, co-rotating along. Okay? So the whole solar system is moving, but then through the year, you can have more or less, even more or less relative velocity relative to what is going on compared to the dark matter. And so that means that you'll have more or less nuclear recoil energy depending on whether it's in the summer or in the winter. So you can look for an annual modulation. Okay? You look for an annual modulation of the nuclear recoil energies that you see. Okay. Looking for dark matter directly like this is another one of the main big experimental programs in this business. And as I say, there's a whole slew of experiments, and lots has been done already. Some experiments claim to signal, even, although it remains controversial. But this is going on and is going to get even more interesting in this decade. So the LHC is just starting up. We can have direct production of dark matter. We can have direct detection of dark matter. Those experiments are relatively powerful already and will be getting more powerful on the 5-year timescale. Did you have a question?
Those last couple experiments, And just like neutrino observatories, is it, are they doing the same kind of thing in neutrino observatories, like a xenon?
The cross sections that you're talking about here are scattering off nuclei. The cross sections here are scattering off nuclei because the dark matter particle is small. Okay, yeah. It's coming along and it's going to scatter off the heaviest thing it can. And that's what's going to give it the biggest recoil it can. It also happens to have the largest coupling, or the biggest collection of matter. Okay, so there's many reasons it's scattering off the nucleus. Neutrinos dominantly don't scatter off the nucleus. Neutrinos at low energies dominantly scatter off the electrons. Okay, and so that's because neutrinos come in with much, much lower energies. Okay, so they scatter off the electrons. The cross sections for neutrinos from like atmospheric neutrinos, for example, are larger than the cross sections are smaller than the cross sections we are talking about. However, remarkably, not this generation of liquid noble gas experiments, but probably the next generation of liquid noble gas experiments should be able to detect the nuclear recoil from atmospheric neutrinos. So indeed, and in fact, unless it's swamped by dark matter, of course, which everyone hopes it will be. but if it isn't, they will actually be able to see they'll be able to see nuclear recoil. I mean, it's a horrendously inefficient way of looking for atmospheric neutrinos. But that's how big it is. So that's how sensitive these experiments are going to be. Now, the final way of looking for them is to read time going this way, the same way it was in the early universe, right, for this process. Just dark matter particles annihilating into ordinary particles. So this is called indirect detection. But the idea is that in places nearby in the universe, like in our galaxy, we have dark matter particles. In fact, the density of dark matter increases a little bit as we head in towards the center of the galaxy. So there's even more of them towards the center than there are here. And even though the density is small, every now and then they'll still annihilate. And they'll annihilate the very, very high energy particles. They can annihilate the very high energy photons. They can annihilate the very high energy matter and antimatter. And particularly, the antimatter is an interesting source of very high energy antimatter. So you can look for high energy photons, antimatter, neutrinos, all sorts of very high energy stuff coming in cosmic rays. Either from the center of the galaxy, you should see more of them coming from the center of the galaxy because the dark matter is getting more clumped there, or more locally. Now, the difficulty with this is that there's other astrophysical sources that also make high energy particles, high energy gamma rays. And so if you start seeing something, there'll begin to be a big argument about whether it's astrophysical or dark matter. In fact, one of the reasons this business has gotten exciting in the past year or so is that there were some very interesting anomalous observations of antimatter in satellite experiments and a balloon experiment roughly 1 year ago, almost exactly 1 year ago. And this triggered a flurry of activity amongst people thinking about dark matter for the sort of thing that could give rise to these signals. It was slightly unusual. It wasn't your most vanilla wimp. It was a slightly more unusual sort of wimp. But it also wheeled up in the astrophysics community, no, we can explain all these things. All these high-energy positrons that you see are actually coming from pulsars. As it turns out, anything can come from pulsars. So that is a difficulty. But on the other hand, it's also very, very interesting. None of these observations are something that by themselves are kind of a smoking gun that would settle the subject. But you can start accumulating evidence and getting more and more pieces that start pointing in the same direction. And there are a few smoking guns. There are a few smoking guns that are possible. For example, there are in the halo of the Milky Way galaxy, there are regions where the dark matter isn't perfectly smoothly distributed. There are regions where there's more of it, less of it. It's still clumpy. And those things are away from places you would expect any astrophysical sources, not towards the center of the problem is that most of the dark matter signal you would expect is coming from near the center of the galaxy, and that's also where most of the crap in the galaxy is at the same time. Okay?
So it would be great to find some signal coming from over there, right? 20 degrees, 30 degrees off from the plane of the galaxy. So if you see that, if you see these subhalos lighting up, dark matter annihilates and their light is coming from there, then that starts being a smoking gun. So what you're seeing is not anything that's coming from conventional astrophysics, but it's something which is coming from the annihilation of new particles. So these indirect detection experiments are also up and running. Okay? They have been for a while, but there is more of them. And there's very precise ones. In particular, the observation of high-energy gamma rays is something that the Fermi satellite is going to start giving us some of their data from around the galactic center very soon. In fact, sometime this week or next week, maybe even this week, maybe it's even released when I missed it, which would be a tragedy. But that's continuing. So every one of the fronts on the subject is coming to an experimental head now, and in the next three, and we should really know much, much, much more in the next, I'd say, 5 years. If there's a WIP out there, I'd be surprised if it isn't caught and understood using these techniques. Although you can never be sure. But it's definitely an exciting time in this business. The kind of back and forth between theory and experiment that one would usually like to see in physics is really humming along quite nicely in this business, probably more than any other of the fields right now. Even in beyond the standard model physics, particle physics, until the LHC turns on and gives us lots of data, we are still stuck, you know, just speculating about what could be solving some of these problems. But there's already data in the dark matter business. It might not be reliable, but there's data to look at and play with. So that's been quite a lot of fun. All right, so that's all I want to say about dark matter. What time is it?
Should we have a 5-minute break?
Let's have a 5-minute break. Great. We're going to switch gears completely after this. So. Oh, yes, please.
I find it funny that when people talk about the LHC in popular articles and the like, it's almost always in the context of Higgs. It's like finding Higgs boson.
Yes. The Higgs is partly the least exciting
thing. That's what I was going to say, is I just didn't realize because I didn't know how to.